welcome back to the Shout Louder podcast. Long time no listen. I have missed you guys. How's lockdown going? Is everybody okay? Are you okay? Good. Today I am talking to one of my personal heroes, Joe Tilston, who you may know from Random Hand, you may know him from Traits, you may know him from Merch Stall, you may know him as a solo artist. He has his fingers in many, many different pies. He's one of those absolute legends in the UK music community who gets involved and is always helpful, always smiling. He always has a good word to say, you know, whenever you see him. We recorded this in January of 2021, just as the third lockdown in the UK was starting to kick off. So we were locked up in our houses, but we still had plenty to talk about. His business Merch Stall has changed a lot in the past year, and I found it fascinating to hear about how he's managed to take some of his contacts from the DIY music community and actually convert that into a business. I also thought it was fascinating hearing about his musical upbringing and being on tour as like a young kid. The kind of lessons that he learned from having musical parents as well and how that's influenced him being in a band now. I also really loved having a really open and honest discussion about the financial hardships and the burden that you take on when you're trying to make a touring band like Random Hand work and, you know, you're trying to make a living from it. And we talked about how the musical landscape's changed and how, you know, is it possible to make money from doing this nowadays? Is it still a viable career? We've also got music from his various projects. We've got music from Random Hand, from Traits, and one of Joe's solo tracks, which is so far unreleased. I loved this podcast. It was one of my favourites to record, and it's really given me the impetus to maybe get a bit more active and speak to some more people. I hope that you guys enjoy this just as much as I did. Without further ado, this is Joe Tilston. Hey Joe, welcome to the Shout Louder podcast.
Hello.
Welcome. How are you doing at the moment?
Doing pretty splendid. As splendid as could be expected in this particularly interesting time. Yeah.
I think one of the last times I saw you was when you were playing at the Brudenell, and I almost completely missed your set because my housemate slash photographer slash best friend lost my car keys.
He lost them on stage behind me, didn't he?
Yeah. So we're in a venue full of 500 people. It's quite dark. You're playing, so there's chaos. And we couldn't find my car keys and we were wandering around and it got to the end of the show. We still not found them. And everyone had cleared out and there are all the plastic pint glasses on the floor, all crushed up where people have stood on them. And I'm raking through them with my hand trying to find my fucking car keys that he's dropped somewhere. And then you came up to me and went, oh, there's a set of keys on stage behind the drum kit. Thanks for that, Joe.
Yeah,
I missed the whole set.
Yeah, I keep on like, because I'm pretty sure I found them like not far from where I was stood. And now, because I remember that story, every time one of those pictures pops up, I kind of try and play where's Sarah's keys. Like, so if I see the gig, I'm just like, oh, I wonder if Sarah's keys are there.
Oh God, I was pissed off at that. But that was a superb show.
Yeah, you were.
But
it was great.
And you played London the day after as well.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, and that was a superb show. That was an incredible show.
Yeah, two bloody good gigs. I really think gigs have, you know, you guys used to do so many shows all at once. And then you had a bit of a break and then you came back and there were fewer shows, but oh my God, they're good.
Yeah. No, we definitely saw, by that point we weren't expecting gigs to be getting better. And they were, which is definitely a pleasant place to be in.
It's the idea of scarcity that I've come up with for it, is that when there are lots of gigs, people will come to them when they can. But when you're playing few gigs, people will really come and they will have the best time. So you took a band that was available all of the time and you made them scarce. So everyone came and ran after you.
Yeah, scarcity was not an issue for a Random Hand fan before the hiatus at all.
That is very, very true.
I think we kind of expected the return to be a little bit like the last gigs out. And then it would kind of plateau a bit and start being like it was before the hiatus or before we even had the last run of gigs. And then, you know, 6 months after we came back, we did a bunch of gigs that turned out to be our biggest gigs ever. You know, we did the Leeds gig, the Brudenell, which was like, oh, this is the best gig we've ever done. And it sold out months before. And then the next day we went to London and played our next best gig we've ever done. As in, like, it's like we kind of the underworld was flooded, so we ended up having the venue move 2 weeks before. You know, we ended up in this venue that was like 200 capacity more than the underworld, and we nearly sold that out. You know, it was unexpected and it was incredible. And we were like, oh, okay, maybe we haven't seen the peak of Random Hand yet. And then what was supposed to happen in this break, well, before, yeah, just before the lockdown happened, we were supposed to do a gig at, I think, a 900 cap venue in London with the Filaments and Just Say Nay and Risking the Ridicule, I think it was. I think that was the lineup. And that was going to be our biggest headline gig to date. And yeah, got cancelled, which is a shame. But, you know, I don't doubt that those opportunities will still be there when we get on the other side of this, if not better. So.
I imagine that, to be honest, I actually imagine a lot of the opportunities are going to increase because people, you know, where there would have been a lot of people specifically wanting to see Random Hand before, I think now there's just a lot of people who are desperate to get out to gigs.
Yeah.
So I'm expecting that when the restrictions are lifted, there'll probably be a boom.
Yeah, I see, absolutely. Like you say about the scarcity thing, you know, it's now everyone's had like an insane scarcity. Like I reckon bands that would normally, you know, consistently sell out 100, 200 capacity venues could probably quite easily get away with booking 400 or 500 capacity venues when we get back to it. You know?
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah, I think, I wonder how long that will last though, because I think, you know how when there's a gig on, it's quite easy to think, oh, do you know what? I really want to go to that gig, but I'm knackered today and actually I might just stay at home. And I think that we're going to lose that for a certain amount of time. I think people are just going to be like, oh, you know what? I need to go out. I need to get out. But then I think, I don't know whether it'll then get back to normal, whether that'll be like a month, a couple of months, or whether that'll be a year. It's hard to say.
All right. I mean, you know, you're right. It won't last forever. I think, you know, conservatively, it'd be something like a year, 18 months, where people are waiting for everybody to come out the woodwork and get those gigs in and do stuff. And then, I mean, it's easy to say that, but, you know, the other thing is you've got to think about the impacts of, the lasting impact of stuff. It's like if England gets itself together because of the vaccine and stuff, and suddenly we can gig and things, but other countries where our other favourite bands are from can't get over because they're not sorted yet. You know, suddenly we might not have any American bands for 2-3 years. You know, if their situation isn't sorted, you know. So actually,
yeah, you're absolutely right.
It's going to have very interesting impacts, and you can't expect how long it's going to be.
No, not at all. I mean, the thing is that the outlook on gigs has been quite negative for the last, you know, few months, and I think, you know, a lot of us are quite tentative about getting excited about them coming back. I'm trying not to think about gigs because, you know, if it gets pushed back even further, I don't want to be sad about that. I don't want to have to put myself through that. But I think actually I'm starting to look at things a lot more positively now. You know, I think that we'll have it again. Whereas a few months ago, I just really wasn't feeling like anything was going to happen for a long time. Strange question for you for after the lockdown though. What would you now imagine that post lockdown there aren't any restrictions on where you can travel or anything like that. Let's pretend that Brexit hasn't happened, you know, and that we don't have an issue with American touring or anything like that. What would you really love to be able to do? Like if you could put together your ultimate gig, whether you play that or not, like what would you like to come out at the end of it?
I don't know. It's a very wild, open-ended question. It is a tough question because the thing is, there's a load of things that I would have loved Random Hand to be able to do that I think largely due to the four individuals involved and the places that everyone are in their lives with the projects they've got on, we're not going to be able to do. You know, like I still would push for it if it was possible, but the two top things that Random Hand wanted to do were go back to Canada and do that again, just because it was so good. You know, and Dan missed out on that. Dan wasn't part of the band then, and like to do that with the current lineup would be just the best thing.
So where did he tour over there before? Did he do the full coast to coast?
No, we just did the East Coast. So it was just all the way around Quebec and Montreal and that kind of stuff, and up and down that side. It was amazing. It was with the Planet Smashers and the Real McKenzies, like. You know, like literally made some amazing friends for life in the Real McKenzies, who actually aren't in the Real McKenzies anymore, but you know, had a great time with them. And then you know, the same with, you know, the Planet Smashers have been friends forever. So that, you know, that was amazing. So to go back and do that would be top of the list, along with getting out to Japan, because we never got to do that, you know.
I'm always surprised that you guys haven't made it to Japan, because I feel like you guys would have a huge audience over there, surely.
It was the first, this is going back to how long Random Hand's been around, but it was the first Credit Crunch, the last...
Oh, like 2009, wasn't that?
Yeah, it was that that stopped it, because right
was
at that
it?
Point... Right. Yeah, because right at that point, every band... Not every band, but all the bands that were really working hard and really starting to, you know, that were getting all the same boxes ticked, like, you know, getting the Radio 1 play, getting the gigs, getting the good supports and that kind of stuff. There was kind of, you could just see it happening. They'd then get something released in Japan and they'd go out to Japan, you know, and that was kind of on the thing. And we were getting, like, we were in conversations, well, Donna from Bomber Records was in conversation with another label over there about releasing a couple of the bands. So it was like, oh wow, this might actually be happening. And it was literally then that the Credit Crunch thing happened, and it hit Japan more than anything initially, I think, and totally destroyed their music industry. And that was the end of that. Never discussed again. Literally not offered again until more recently, that now there's a bit of a more of a DIY thing going on.
There's definitely, well, there's the guys from R&R Tours who have been pretty great about getting lots of bands from within our kind of DIY scene over there. And they've kind of got, it's almost like a tour package worked out where they've got certain venues, certain festivals, certain support bands and things like that. And I know that they've had like Faintest Idea and things like that out, and that's been pretty successful. And it's interesting because to me it seems to be the kind of the ska punk bands, but also the... like skate punk bands seem to go over really, really well. Mm. And I feel like, you know, you guys are so fast and energetic that would be perfect. So hopefully, you know, fingers crossed.
Yeah.
At least Japan won't be affected by Brexit.
Yep, it will be exactly the same.
There you go. There's a bonus for you. Mm-hmm. But what about Canada? Would you like to do the full country, or would you want to go back to where you were?
The thing with a lot of the expanse of the country is so big. I don't know.
I mean, it is just one road, though.
Yeah, it's fair enough.
It's just the Highway 1 going the whole way.
It's just, I think, the thing with Random Hand is we're not in a position where we're in our 20s anymore and we can... Well, we tried to make a living out of this. We tried to make a living out of it. We tried harder than any band I know to make a living out of this. You know, we lived in squalor, like, financially. We had, you know, we were paying the smallest amount of rent to exist. You know, we lived... When we were doing 250 gigs a year, I was putting on my self-assessment tax return between $3,000 and $5,000. You know, that's how much money I made.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it was that was only because I was eating on tour on the rider, you know, that I could afford to do that. It was a hard thing to do financially. What I've done is I've distracted myself with my own answer and forgotten what your actual question was. What were we talking about?
Oh, no, we've gone off on a tangent. We don't need to answer specific questions.
Where was I going with this, Sarah? I was
fantasy gig. Fantasy post-lockdown. But touring Canada, you were saying the time.
That was it. We used to have all that time in the world to kind of go off and do those things. And we'd spend 30 days on the road, come back for 2 weeks, another 30 days on the road. That was it, straightforward. We can't do that anymore. You know, families, jobs. But, you know, you simply can't afford to do it. You know, no one's buying records. No one's, you know.
No, that's true.
You know, it's simply, they're not, you know, and I'm not going to get into that. You know, I'm not angry about it. It's just the way it is. You know, but that lack of any financial support means people can't do this full time unless they're prepared to sacrifice real life. And I think
I think you're absolutely right.
Now we're all in our mid-30s. Like, we want to have a real life. You know, I sacrificed so many relationships and stuff before. So that's the very convoluted answer to, we could only really go there for 2 weeks.
That's fascinating, though. Actually, that kind of leads me to another point, which is, you're absolutely right. I remember you guys were one of the most hardworking bands around for a long time. And obviously, that's kind of why you had to take that hiatus, was because you put just so much into it that you needed a break from it, which is, you know, admirable, to be honest. I think it's better to recognise that than to split up as a band.
Yeah.
But since you were kind of, you know, really living on the breadline with that and investing so much time and energy into getting that done, because it's not just the finances, it takes a lot out of you, right? Do you think that the musical landscape has changed in terms of the way bands can make money since then. So I guess what I mean is that a long time ago, well, maybe not even that long ago, 10 years ago, should we say, let's go back to 2009. Mm. Back then, I think for me, I would have expected a band to make a fair amount, you know, maybe out of like the actual fees for the gigs, out of merch sales. You know, you guys always had incredible merch, like what Si Mitchell did by building a brand for you guys worked incredibly well. Mm. You know, all of his t-shirts, all of his designs were spot on. But surely merch was a good way of making cash, but then also records and CDs. You know, before the vinyl boom even, wasn't that in like 2009? That was CD time. Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah, you guys didn't release anything on vinyl until more recently, did you?
No. No, I mean, the vinyl thing very much kind of became a tangible... For a long time... I felt like the vinyl boom was a lot of very a small number of very enthusiastic individuals making it sound like it was better than it was, and I still don't think I was wrong on that. You know, I think it more recently.
I think that group of individuals has grown.
Yeah, and yeah, absolutely. I think now it is. You know, it's absolutely pivoted to a point now where people want to buy records and not CDs. You know, to the point where labels don't want to release a CD anymore. So it has changed that much. The problem with the vinyl boom is you get this incredible product. It's you really want to invest in it again. You want to listen to it like you did albums when you were a teenager. It's great, but it costs so much to make that actually, you know, when a CD cost £1 to make when you were making 1,000, you know, you got, you know, £1, £2 went into it. There was actually a margin for a band to make some money out of it on the road. Whereas with vinyl, it's a total ego thing. You know, it's like, okay, cool, we get to sell this, but we are literally facilitating someone getting that thing. We're not making any money out of it. So, the opportunities have been decimated.
It's really dwindled, hasn't it? And I think, I mean, you're absolutely right. In vinyl, there's so little profit margin for bands. Mm. And especially if you're, you know, in any way splitting the cost with the label as well, that makes it even tougher. And I think you're right. I think vinyl, to an extent, is a vanity project for a lot of people. Mm. You know, you get your fancy splatter and you get your really nice gatefold cover, and each little part of that costs a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And there's only so much that customers are going to be willing to pay for that. But I think all of this, and, you know, obviously the decline of CDs has been built out of streaming. Because we can access as much music as we want now. Mm. And actually, I'm all for streaming. Like, I remember years ago when piracy was a big thing, you know, when there was that everyone was trying to crack down on it because it was illegal and all that kind of thing. But actually, it's just a really good form of promotion. It's a way of getting your band out to more people.
Mm. We almost were fully into it.
Stuff like Spotify is like the current piracy argument in a way. Mm. But obviously, bands aren't making music through streaming. Bands aren't really making a lot of profit through vinyl. I don't really think anyone's making much money off playing gigs.
No. I think people assume that, you know, if a band makes 400, 500 quid from a gig, they're making a profit there. And it's so hard to make that money work. You know, like I said, you know, we were doing 250 gigs a year at one point, and we were getting anything from, I can't remember what our guarantees were at that point, but they were anything from £250 to £550 probably over that period. And you know,
which was still really good.
It was incredible, but we were in
that was great.
We were in intense amounts of debt. You know, like every time we went out on the road, we would end up XYZ more in debt, you know, £1,000 more in debt. And we'd have to borrow money from one person to pay another person. And we were just going in this cycle down and down and down. And it wasn't until we said, let's go on hiatus and stop and did the pledge campaign for that last album. That was the only time in 10 years that Random Hand, that we left at all with an actual profit. Not just even the hint of minimum wage, like an actual profit, you know, like for our time. And we paid off our debts, you know, and so we had to stop to pay off the debts. You know, if we'd have carried on, we'd have just carried on sinking down, you know. And
it's ridiculous. You know,
when you say the word debt, people just think, well, why are you borrowing money? But this isn't like, we're not borrowing money to buy things. We were borrowing, we were borrowing money from the record label and the publisher to buy a new van. We were borrowing, we were getting merch on credit to buy a new van. You know, we were kind of, we were not paying like fees to our agent because he was our manager and he was really lenient. But at some point we had to go, oh, we haven't paid you anything for 2 years. Is this all right? And he'd go, not really. And we go, that's fair. You're fair, firm but fair. Here's the rest of it, you know. And so, like, it's not like we were going out borrowing money to, like, to even promote the band or anything like that. We were just getting in debt existing, you know. So,
yeah.
Yeah, you know. Yeah.
I guess what I was going to say is I think, particularly from a fan perspective, people just don't consider the financial pressure that comes with being in a band and the financial side of touring and all that kind of thing, you know. I think people focus on the fun, and I tend to think that people are quite a quality act. Like, you know, if you pay enough for your ticket to get into the show, you tend to assume that all of that money is going to the band, and that, and you view your, let's say you've paid a tenner for a ticket, you think that that tenner is fully profit that's going in their pockets so that they can pay for their dinner for that night or whatever. But there are so many costs in the background behind it, it's just impossible to manage. And that's why, I don't know, I think it's important that people nowadays go into any kind of musical venture with the right view on it. Don't expect to make a profit, but it's a bonus if you do, sort of thing. But I don't know, do you think it's possible for bands, say within our community, to make any, you know, to make a living out of it nowadays? Do you think there's a route for people to do that?
I don't know. I want to pick on something you just said there, which is, you know, to have that attitude, you should come in with an attitude not to make money and stuff. And it's weird because I've never once made a decision, well, no, you know, I have not made the decisions that get me in a place to make money. I'm in a punk band, you know, that plays ska punk. It was totally on the way out by the time we started. You know, we were just lucky enough that it wasn't quite the same as some, you know, and the same with the other stuff I do. None of it is like mainstream stuff, you know. So I didn't come into it wanting to make money, but I don't think, you know, you kind of expect to get to a point where hopefully it'll be able to support you at some point. And I think in order for music to really bloom, for music to really like to sing and be influential and stuff, it has to be able to support itself. An artist has to be able to make a living from it, you know, and they absolutely should. And the idea that some people get this, you know, think, oh, they're so lucky they're making a living off this. No, they've worked hard for it. And it isn't a rosy, fun living. You know, it's still hard work.
No.
But they absolutely earn the right to make money out of it and to be supported by it. And they shouldn't have to use every other aspect in their life to support it. And the other thing is, so many people are judging those people that are trying to make a living out of it, you know, saying, you know, they're sellouts, all this kind of stuff. Well, are you surprised? You know, like, yes, they should take money from wherever possible if it's going to stop them from having to go and work for minimum wage. Like, I've been sat on a solo album for 2 years now because I've so busy trying to make a business that can support me for the rest of my life, you know. Like, you know, I'm kind of lucky that I decided to retrain and stop living in the arts 5 years ago because I'd be screwed now if the pandemic had hit me 5 years ago.
You've got a fair point there.
You know, I think it's a really difficult, complex situation for musicians, and I don't think people treat them fairly enough in the way that they absolutely should be supported better. And, you know, you've got the army of people saying they should only pay £5 a entry for a ticket. Get over it. You'll pay £13 to go and sit and watch a film that some multimillionaires have made, but you won't go and pay £10 to go and watch a band that have sweated and live in squalor to make this stuff happen for you. Like, get a grip, you know. Like, these people deserve support.
I 100% agree with you.
And if you're not going to, and the thing is, you know, I used to buy records every week, you know, I don't now, you know. But like,
no.
So that economy is decimated, you know. Like, you know, my parents were independent. Well, no, they weren't DIY, but they were as DIY as I am, you know, in the folk industry. I watched them do that growing up, and they made their, you know, they released an album and then could afford to pay the mortgage. You know, Random Hand release an album, and we're in £1,000 debt minimum. You know, you know, you know. It's like, unless we're doing
crazy,
gigs,
isn't
you
it?
Know.
Yeah, yeah. I'll get onto this a bit later, but I do want to ask you about your family, and I want to talk about Merch Stall as well, of course. But I entirely agree with all your points there, and actually, I think perhaps I'd worded that a bit differently. I think that you're right. In order for art to flourish, it should be supported. But we're just not in an economy where that's happening at the moment, are we?
Yeah.
But then equally, I'd bring it back to the point of scarcity again. So, for example, with the gig ticket issue, I think we should all be paying more for gigs. And actually, I hope that this break, there you go, that's something I'd love to get out of the pandemic. I hope that this break can give us an opportunity to increase ticket prices, which sounds, you know, like punks will turn around to me and be like, oh, that's money grabbing, or you're trying to profit off of it. No, it's because we ought to value the art more highly. You know, we really, really, really value live shows. Yeah. We value this music. We ought to be, you know, we need to make sure that what we're paying for it equates to that. And yeah, maybe having a break will mean that promoters can do that a little bit. And I think I slightly lost my train of thought there, actually.
It's because we're so out of practice of chatting to each other. That's what it is.
I haven't talked to actual humans for a while. but I suppose my extra point there would be that, you know, although you want to charge more for gigs, I think it's the scarcity issue. Again, it's... we've been used to there being an incredible amount of gigs. There are so many bands that want to play gigs that we can't fit them all in on lineups. You know, there are people clamoring to play Manchester Punk Festival. There are people, you know, like Tree's got people lined up around the door to play gigs in Manchester. You know, there's so many people who want to do it, and there are not quite enough promoters to put on, you know, the amount that would mean that every single one of those bands could play. And then beyond that, you know, it depends where you live. Certainly, when I lived in Ipswich for a year, and there'd be a punk gig once a month. So I would go to that gig. I would absolutely be there for it. Whereas in Manchester, there's potentially, you get weeks where there's four or five punk gigs a week, and I can't go to all of those, you know? So it's that scarcity. Once you have, if there were fewer gigs, you'd be able to charge more for them. And if there were fewer bands, they'd be able to charge more. But there's just so much out there at the moment that, you know, it almost diminishes the value of it because there's just, yeah, there's just so much. But I just think that every artist should be able to make a living. I don't think anyone should expect to make a living out of DIY punk, but I'd bloody love it if people could. I really would. That would be a wonderful goal.
I think it's going to be a long time before we see a major shift and a major change. I don't know what the answer is. It's probably going to get, sadly, it's probably going to get harder for a while and probably worse for a while, in the fact that you're going to see the people that, and well, you're already seeing it in like the mainstream music, you know, the people that are making a living out of it and coming to the front are people that have got money behind them from the day one. You know, the people with rich families, and with that, you impact art. You know, you're not getting these breakthrough artists in the same way you would have done 15, 20 years ago. You know, you're not going to get a band like Gallows having a record label, you know, throwing that money at someone like that again. You know, but you used to have one like that every month. You know, you had Hell Is for Heroes, 100 Reasons, all this kind of stuff would be, have the money thrown at them, and they'd be they'd go through the charts. But you're not going to, you're just not going to see that. You know, or you're not going to see genuine homegrown artists doing that. You're going to see people that, like I say, that have come from rich families, and you lose so much integrity, and you lose a lot of heart and soul.
It's almost part that there's that romanticism around the ideal of the starving artist, you know? So, you know, we kind of look at people who come from that background where they've kind of scraped their way up from the bottom, and you look at that really, really fondly, but that almost makes you think that you shouldn't be paying artists in a way. That just that the romantic ideal behind it is not quite right. I don't know. Someone give me some money. I'll take it. I'm joking. Well, I tell you what, since we've been talking about Random Hand, why don't we play a Random Hand track? And we were thinking perhaps one of the ones from the newer album.
Yeah, which is probably 6 years old now.
Oh my God, it is.
Yeah. Yeah,
how has that happened?
Yeah.
Christ.
We better get making a new one.
yes, you should. I imagine you've got enough pressure for that already.
I'm the one making the pressure. But
Could put yourself in £1,000 worth of in a grand's worth of debt in the process, by the sounds of it.
No, so. Do you know what? I think we'll be all right. We'll be all right if we did another one. But let's play If I Save Your Back.
Perfect. Okay. Well, this is If I Save Your Back by Random Hand. Reach out for the cry calling. Reach out when the cry keeps calling. Reach out for the cry calling. Reach out when the cry keeps calling. Reach out for the cry calling. Reach out when the cry keeps calling. Reach out for the cry calling. Reach out when the cry keeps calling. Reach out for you to liberate. To lead it up with empathy. Oh, no comfort, no safety, no status, it's a hate me. Now there's just me and you. Reach out for the cry calling. Reach out when the cry keeps calling. Reach out for the cry calling. Reach out when the cry keeps calling. Reach out for the cry calling. Reach out when the cry keeps calling. Now this can be some mystery. How can you challenge sympathy? That was If I Save Your Back by Random Hand. So that was one from your most recent album.
Yeah, hit reset.
Not going to put any pressure on you to record a new one at the moment, but have you enjoyed being able to play that one live?
We haven't played that one live.
It's that not, track, no.
Yeah, it's not like, I don't know, I don't think everyone in the band has got the same love for it as I do. There's something about it. For me, it's like it's quite different to the rest of the tracks on the album. It's got a different vibe. I really like where it goes with breakdown wise and that kind of stuff. I just thought it was a little bit of a, I don't know. It felt for me as a music thing, it just felt fresher than a lot of the other stuff on the album.
I think there was a lot of on Hit Reset. It did seem like you guys were playing around with your sound a little bit more, and I mean that in a good way. But it really sounded like you were trying to bring in like some different influences or some slightly different styles.
Yeah.
And it felt quite reflective, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. But that's the only recording you've done with the current lineup, is that right?
Yeah.
That must have been cool.
It was. It was great. It was different on a lot of levels because all the other albums we'd done with Pete Miles, in one way or another, and I think when we got Sean on board, we kind of were halfway through writing Seething. Well, not halfway. We'd written three of the songs that ended up on Seething with Dimmers, Joe Dimmiotti's, our old drummer. So we kind of were already in the process with that. And when Sean came in, it was like, right, we've got to hit the ground running. We've got to show that this, you know, losing a member isn't going to slow anything down. Get on with it, you know. And we'd... I mean, we'd written Inhale Exhale in a very quick, very small window that we kind of went with the same attitude with Seething, so just got on it. So those three albums felt like they were done on the bounce, and that was that.
Yeah.
Whereas when a lot changed when we changed to Dan. Like we were all kind of burnt out anyway, and a burnout. The burnout absolutely contributed to the meltdown that we had, you know, but you know, in every way, you know, it was showing in all of us, you know. We'd all had enough, and that, you know, manifested in us getting rid of Matt and, you know, getting Dan in, and because of that burnout, we kind of put ourselves in a position where we wanted to get Dan in the band. We knew we'd get on well with him. Sean had been in chief with him. And we knew he was a great player. When Dan was like, well, I'm into it, but I'm a teacher and I'm not leaving my job because I've got a mortgage. It was like, oh, okay, right. Well, we want to make it work. So we'll just kind of, we'll aim to do less gigs. Let's try and do that. So we kind of took a step back anyway. So the kind of all in aspect changed there. You know, that's when it was like, we all got given this room to kind of be random hand and something else, which we didn't have before that. So it wasn't for a long time before we properly got into the writing. You know, it was probably maybe a year or two before the writing really properly began with Dan in the mix. And then when we finally started writing with Dan, Dan was like, you know, he was living and breathing the songs that we'd already had. It wasn't like we were bringing someone in that didn't know Random Hand. It's like he'd been molded into it. So he fully got the mix.
Well, he always felt like he was really a part of it, you know, from an audience perspective. It felt like he'd never not been in the band for a while.
Yeah, so. No. It was a really quick integration. And I think he was just, after, he'd been the guy in chief that did what I do for Random Hand. You know, he'd done all the work and all that.
Oh, he's that guy.
He was that guy. He'd done all the ground, like the heavy work in, and felt like it didn't really, you know, didn't materialize how it was. So when he was kind of offered Random Hand, he was like, ah, you know, he literally just got to come in and do all the good stuff, you know? He was pretty pleased with that, I think.
There's one of those guys in every single band. But why is it that whatever band you're in, there's only one of those guys? There never seems to be two or three of those guys.
I don't know. We haven't really talked about Traits, but Traits was a beautiful little moment of musical time.
Go on, dive into Traits.
So I think, we got four people that all did shit, you know? there was no pulling teeth. You know, occasionally Dan would be slow to confirm something, but like, that was the worst we had to deal with. Everyone was like so on it, listening to stuff, engaging stuff, like throwing in ideas in, making stuff happen. And it's like, part of me always thought, I hate being the only guy that's driving certain things, but like, with Random Hand and stuff, but maybe it could be too many cooks if other people were trying. Well, actually, no. Four cooks is great, and it's really effective. It was with that band for that period of time, and I think because all four of us were, well, John hadn't really been in a band that had done anything, but like we were all in a place where we wanted to do something that was didn't have the stresses, didn't have the baggage of bands that do have that have been going for years, you know, and kind of learn from our mistakes and just dive in and have a lot of fun. And like literally, I think Johnny's MO for it was, I want a band where I can have some beers and not have to drive home. I was like, okay, Let's do it.
Whereas the Human Project, you know, it's not, no, it's quite hard what they're playing. Yeah. It's very technical.
Yeah, 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 definitely, you know. And I think...
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so that was it, you know, we got to have that. And it was a real breath of fresh air being in a unit that was like that. And yeah, not that I've got any problem with Random Hand, but...
But it was fun. I think, you know, I think that raises an interesting point that sometimes I think you can be in the right band at the right time with the right group of people who are all in the right place in life. Mm. And even if that only lasts for a couple of years, that's all right as well. Like, it doesn't need to be like a forever thing with a massive goal or a plan at the end of it. But you guys, when you were playing together a couple of years ago, I just remember thinking, you guys are all in the right place at the right time. This seems like a good fit. And you guys did some great work as well. I maintain that music video you guys did with the giant penis is one of the best music videos ever created. I sometimes forget that happens and I laugh at it.
The thing about that is, so like, again, this is a point of like how productive that band was. Like, Random Hand have spent so long talking about ideas that have never happened. Yeah. Like, there's a process of, that's a good idea, that's a good idea, that's a good idea, and then someone will have that, oh, but I think I take myself a bit more seriously than that, you know, and, like, there'll be suddenly, the idea will stop, you know, and that's that, which is really frustrating, but c'est la vie, that's it. Traits, it's like, had a few beers in the back of a taxi, say to Johnny, you know that song? Have you seen these costumes? What? They exist. Yeah. I've bought one. Okay, like in a 15 minute taxi drive from my house to the Brudenell Social Club. I think we were going to watch Future of the Left. It was either Future of the Left or another band, Eureka Machines. That was it. So we got in a 15 minute taxi drive. I pitched that idea, and Johnny had bought the stuff we need to do it, and that was that. Within a week, we were filming it, you know, and it was great.
Oh, but that's the way that you need to do things sometimes. That it's that spontaneity that makes it fun, though. Sometimes you can think about an idea to the point that you don't like it anymore, you know. I'm terrible at that. I have so many ideas for things I want to do, and then I just sort of don't do them. Mm-hmm. Or a new idea will come along that I think is even better, and then a new idea will come along that I think is even better than that, and I just, you know, I won't progress it. Is anything happening with Traits now, or is that sort of on the quiet?
The whole thing that was there was because it was this super brilliant meeting of four people at the time, and Dan left the country to, he moved to Moldova.
He moved to Moldova,
which is, you know, fine, you know, but he, that was kind of it really. And we just didn't click again after that, you know. No rhyme or reason for it really. I think, what happened is that happened, and then Random Hand started again, and Human Project released that epic album. So it's kind of like, you know, it's understandable that those two projects would pick up and move on past it.
Traits was quite a nice way of tying together your like local group as well, because you've got Random Hand, you've got the Human Project, you've got Sounds of Swami. There's like a little group of you guys around the Leeds area.
Yeah.
I say that broadly because I know you're not in Leeds. But there just seems like a few of you who are all very, very, very talented and very enthusiastic and full of ideas and all that kind of thing as well. And it seemed to me like Traits was like a little meeting of all of those different groups kind of at the same time.
Yeah,
that's nice to see.
No, it was good. And I think we as lockdown, to literally the week of the lockdown starting again, we were going to have Mr. Madfish McMinn, the old SP6 drummer, was going to come over and have a jam with us.
Oh, really?
And then lockdown happened.
Woo!
So, I don't know. There was definitely a drive to make it happen again with another great drummer, you know. But it did not materialise.
No, but that's the way of life currently.
Yeah.
What have you been doing to cope with the lockdown? Now, you must be quite busy working still as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I've just
having
basically
set up your own business.
Been working. So, I've after a decade of touring and doing all that kind of stuff. Like, I very much, and living with fuck all money, you know, I kind of very much have a, my time is more valuable than my paycheck vibe, you know. And like, I'd, even though Random Hand was not my main thing anymore and music was not my main thing, like, it still defined me more than anything else in my life. And I would, I'd still put it first, hands down, you know.
Yeah.
And I grew up, music was the measure of someone's success. So I kind of, it always was the reason why I'd get out of bed in the morning. If I had a gig, that's the most important thing. The, what the lockdown has done has meant, well, sorry, before the lockdown, before the COVID, I would begrudgingly be building a business. I'd be begrudgingly doing this work. I was begrudgingly working for whoever I was working for beforehand and all that kind of stuff. But I did it because I needed to do it to support this stuff. And the idea of me having my own business so I could do the music, once it got to a point I could do the music as and when I wanted, it was always, that was always the means of the business, was getting it to a point where I can do as much of the stuff that I want to do as much as possible.
Building that work-life balance, like where you can actually manage your time in a way that suits you and suits your creativity.
So
as well.
I can go, I want to go away for 7 days and I can still run the business from my laptop while I'm on the road and I've got the people working, you know, it kind of stuff. But the moment COVID came along, I didn't have the fear of missing out thing. I didn't have the, you know, I didn't have, I couldn't
There's
go
a lot
to a
that's
gig
been removed.
I couldn't go to a gig in Leeds. And I wasn't annoyed because I was exhausted. So I didn't hate the job because I was too exhausted to do the fun things. You know, like, I'm not turning things down, which in itself is a drain, you know. And I turned so much stuff down that I wanted to do just because I was exhausted, because I was tired. You know,
it's surprising how draining that is, actually, isn't it? Because saying no to people, particularly often it's friends, isn't it? And you say, you know, I want to do that, but I haven't got the energy to.
And the existential dread that brings on, everyone thinks I'm a shit. You know, because I'm not doing the thing, you know. And,
the thing is that no one ever actually thinks that of you, do they?
Probably
you know, it's
not.
All,
well, I don't know.
It's maybe. All up here in our own head. For me, it's my inbox. You know, my inbox is a scary place sometimes. And you know what? The inbox is not a scary place. I've just imagined that it is. Mm-hmm. Like, I think, I can tell you, Joe, that I think everyone looks upon you as someone who does a lot already. And I don't think anyone would think twice of you for turning something down.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. It's easy to feel like I'm not doing enough. And when I'm sat on an album for 2 years and I'm, you know, I haven't finished making three videos that I've been trying to make and all these things that I've wanted to do aren't happening. You know, Random Hand is sat on 5 demos that haven't turned into anything yet. You know, we haven't booked a studio. We haven't done this, we haven't done that. It's so easy to feel like I'm not doing anything, you know, but...
Do you find there's almost like this to-do list,
like
just this in your head cycling constantly going round and around and around? I have that with various like ideas for things. Like I'll be thinking, oh, I'm going to do a podcast with this person or, you know, I've just done this book. So now I'm thinking, right, okay, well, I should do that book and that
book.
We should
talk about
this
book. I'm
going to write an article about that. We can talk about the book, but I'm here to talk about you as well.
But I literally opened it because it only turned up yesterday and I opened it.
Oh, really?
I opened it. It's here.
Cool.
Which is
it's a real thing. It's got Joe on it as well.
I know, it's amazing. I complimented him on his cover thing, and I've literally only had time to read Robin's story, which was obviously the first thing I went to. But like,
yeah,
it's awesome, you know. Like, and that's
so glad that Robin wrote something. He was one of the people. I got some amazing submissions, but I also had it in the back of my head. I thought, you know what? There's a couple of people I'd like to actually approach and ask them to write something. And he was one of the people that I went to and said specifically, I've got this project I'm working on. I'd really like for you to be a part of it. Mm. And when he sent over his story, he was almost apologetic because it was 3 times the word limit. and it was slightly off topic. And he was like, oh, yeah, if you don't have to use it if you don't want to. You know, it might not be the right thing for it. And I was like, I think this might be my favourite thing in here.
It is good. It's very good.
He's an excellent writer. So I was just keen to have that in there, really.
Yeah. No, but it's by no means a small achievement. You know, it's an incredible little thing. So you should be very proud of that.
It's been a strange project, to be honest, because... through making the books, I'm starting to gain more of an understanding, perhaps, of how some bands feel about albums and things like that. So it's strange that so much work goes into it up front. You know, obviously I had to pull all that together, you know, get all the contributions from different people. And then the actual process of putting it together was one of the most stressful experiences of my life. Mainly because I didn't do it until closer to my own deadline than I should have done. You know, I could have just started it earlier and it would have been fine. But it coincided with, I started a new job at the exact same time that I was about to start editing it and putting it together. So I was trying to concentrate on this new, you know, proper job, in quotations, and then just trying to balance that with doing the book. I ended up working these crazy hours. Like, you know, I was working at like 2 o'clock in the morning on a Thursday trying to sort the layout out. And I put all that work into it. But to be honest, once that was sort of done, I kind of forgot about it for a bit. And now, you know, I sent out hundreds last week, so they've all arrived on people's doorsteps sort of yesterday and today. And, you know, for me, it's like, oh, this is cool. I've done a thing. It's cool. But I got all these photos sent to me yesterday and loads of messages to tell me about it. You know, people screenshotting bits that they'd like really enjoyed and stuff like that. And that's brilliant. And I'm so grateful to them. But I was a bit overwhelmed. I was a bit like, oh, God, people actually like it and are reading it. And I didn't really know how to handle it. Like, I wasn't expecting that to stress me out, but it did.
Right.
So it
stressed you out getting the feedback? Or?
Well, I don't know if stressed is the right word, but it was all a bit much at once. I think because 100 arrived on the same day, and I then got text messages from, like, you know, 50 people. I was like, whoa, okay, I need to put my phone down.
I mean,
it's been amazing to have some good feedback on it, honestly.
Well, I think you should be very proud and you should do another one. I mean, just do it. It's good. I mean, I would have loved to have contributed, but I was too busy.
Well, this is it, you know, and there were so many people as well that I sort of said, oh, well, you know, I gave a few people a nudge and said, if you fancy doing anything for this, then, but there's never any pressure. I would like to do another one, but I'm not quite sure what theme it would take. Mm. And to be honest, I kind of want to do something else now as well, because like you said, these new ideas keep coming at you. And although the book was amazing and I'd love to try and do it again, there's sort of two sides to it. Firstly, I basically had to teach myself graphic design. Mm-hmm. And now that I've played with that a bit more, I kind of want to try and design something properly and maybe do like a magazine that's really heavily stylized rather than, you know, lots of content, I guess. Yeah. But then on the other end of that, now that I've printed a book, I'm like, well, I know it's a bit of a vanity thing, but I kind of want to do one that's just my writing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe try and write some short stories.
You should do that.
Like what Robin's done, to be honest. Write 12 of what Robin's written.
Yeah.
Yeah. But whether I actually get round to that is a whole different thing.
Well, there's no time limit on these things, is there? You know.
No, apart from the ones that we impose upon ourselves. Mm. Yeah. Like you said, so you've been sat on a solo album for 2 years?
Yeah, and then some. Well,
you've had a lot go on in the time that that's been in the works, though, haven't you?
Yeah, I got married. My house flooded.
Yeah.
The house flooding.
While you were on honeymoon, wasn't
it? Yeah, that was shit.
Yeah. I still felt bad about that. Yeah. I thought about that the other day when a ceiling was leaking. Yeah. And I thought, oh, well, at least I'm not Joe.
A friend of mine's just had bought a house, and the whole floor's rotted, and it didn't come up on the surveys and stuff, so they've moved into this house, and it just brought back the fear, the shock. It was just like,
oh God.
I know it's not the same situation, but I feel for you. Like, you know, there's this, having something that you've, you know, we'd lived here for a year. Was it longer than that? I forget. A good year or two, and then suddenly to, you know, to have it, literally half of it ripped out while we were on our honeymoon. We came back expecting it to be bad, but it was actually far worse than we thought. And to come back from our honeymoon and like still on our high from this amazing wedding, this amazing honeymoon, driving across America, like couldn't have been better. And then literally came to our home missing and having to live for 3 months in our bedroom and our kitchen. Like, Christ. Totally flipped that buzz round to from being the best to the worst, you know. And like, you know, no one's going to operate well in that. Not only did I come home to that, but I also came home to my business partner saying that he didn't want to do it anymore. He didn't want to do merch store anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so I kind of, you know, it was a double-sided, oh, everything's fucked. Okay. Get, you know, that's that now. So I was sat on this album and all of, you know, I've spent, you know, I've now been running merch store by myself for, since November the year before the, yeah, since the November before the COVID hit. So over a year.
Yeah.
And I've had to teach myself to screen print. I wasn't the screen printer. You know, I was helping, but I wasn't the screen
printer.
Well,
you're not. I didn't know. So,
no, it was the other guy. I just knew all the bands in the world. So I just thought, you know, I could bring some work in. So I got reasonable at it, but I definitely wasn't an authority on it. And I've since trained two other people out of to do it, and I've grown the business, and it's doing all right, you know. So I've
Brilliant.
Been a bit I've been a bit distracted, you know, and not been able to do the fun
I think you should forgive yourself for not having time to do the fun thing quite so much. But
well, I suppose I can forgive myself the last year because, like, at the end of the day, I need some security, so I need to put it into that. And I need to put it into the job. And now you mention it, you're right. I do have a few excuses. I got married and the house was flooded and I hadn't really thought about that. So, you know, I've had a bit distracting me.
There has also been a global pandemic as well. You know, I think we all need to forgive ourselves if we haven't done quite as much as normal in the last few months. And that's fine. Mm. You know, it adds a layer of stress to your life that, you know, you've never had, like most of us have never had any kind of comparative event that's shut down our lives for this long, you know, with merch store then. So it seems outwardly to be doing quite well. Are you still getting a reasonable amount of business in lockdown? Cause I assume you rely a fair amount on bands doing merch, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Well, so this time last year, it was just me printing by myself most days of the week, you know, trying to keep things going. And it was, I think, June last year where I brought on my first member of staff. And then October, I brought on the second member of staff. And then by November, I wasn't printing anymore. I was just kind of managing all the workload and stuff.
Have been nice bringing on some new people.
Yeah, it's been great. Honestly, after I pretty much spent most of a year, at least 7 or 8 months working by myself, which is a thing that I never wanted to do. I never wanted to work by myself. I'm always working a team player, but I was forced into this position and it was weird because the idea of it was awful, but actually I rose to the occasion and totally did it. You know,
Excellent.
I went in every day by myself, manage my work, you know, which is weird because, like, you know, you always get asked those questions in, like, job interviews and stuff like that, and it's like, well, you're blagging this idea of, oh, I'm self-motivated and I work well in a team. You know, I always thought the self-motivated stuff was a total, like, total bollocks, but actually, turns out I can do that and, you know, get it to a point now that I'm building a team, building a proper business, and, yeah, so things are going really well. You know, I don't know if we'd be in this position if it wasn't for COVID. The reality is I'd actually kind of got to a point where I'd had enough of working by myself. And if COVID hadn't hit, I might have got another job and started again with merch stall and kind of had it on the as a side burner rather than a full-time thing. But those options got taken off the table. So I had to go in for it and go for it. So I've made it what it is and we're doing all right. Got to do all the boring stuff. I've got to put people on PAYE. I've got to go VAT registered and I've got to go limited at the end of the tax year. You know, very boring stuff that isn't very punk rock. But
No, but that's brilliant though. You've created your own business. And like you say, the point of having that there rather than working for, you know, another company, for example, means that once you're in that position, you can then support yourself in order to give you the freedom to do more creative things. Mm. And that's okay. I think that's really important to be able to do. And I do still see, you know, I think doing, you know, having a screen printing business or, you know, doing other kinds of merch as well is just a really good way of staying engaged in the scene or engaged with music, not necessarily the scene. I think, you know, that's maybe not the right word, but I think you've done a really good job there, Joe. Congratulations. You've actually got this business.
Yeah. And that was the point. It was, I mean, that's kind of the reason why I wanted to leave my job beforehand, was because I was dealing with very high stress situations in a very, you know, in a charity, and it was amazing, but I wasn't being me. I was making all these friendships that were all about dealing with emergencies, and it felt like I was two people. And, you know, as much as, you know, some people are fine with that and that's their daily lives and that's fine, but I've seen something else. I've been this other person. I've been a full-time musician. I've been out there, and I'd rather that was me. I'd rather that was who I was. Yeah, so even though I am not playing a single note of music in my day to day, all the people that
you're
dealing
still a musician.
With, but they're the same kind of people. So I'm dealing with people that I used to go on tour with that are now running breweries, you know, Signature Brew. They used to be in Grown at Home. We did loads of tours with them, you know. And there's, you know, another guy there who's a mate from home. So I'm dealing with them, you know. And then there's all the bands that we go on tour with, easy, you know. And so it's the same, it's who I've been for 10 years. Well, yeah, it's basically essentially
you're
making a business out
of... You're not losing your identity through this job.
Yeah.
You know, I think actually, I'm sure a lot of musicians struggle with that, but certainly I've had issues with it in the past where, you know, you talk about imposter syndrome in certain jobs, right? You know, some of us, like you say, we're self-motivated team players that get decent jobs out of somewhere. You know, like somehow you manage to hold down a job while still doing like weekends of crazy touring and gigs and, you know, crashing on people's floors and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I've had some decent jobs in the past and I often felt like I was not worthy of the job that I was in. But then it took me a while to realise it wasn't actually about a self-confidence thing. It's more that when I was going to work and I was, you know, maybe not there in a suit or whatever, but, you know, if I was putting on like a certain... It was almost like I'd put on a layer on top to make myself more socially acceptable. And I think that the older I've gotten, the more I realised that there was like this... It wasn't that there was an alter ego. It's just that the me who would turn up to gigs was like the real me. Yeah. And then I'd have to kind of almost cover that up and normalize it to take it to work. Whereas now that I'm maybe a little bit older and a bit more confident, I feel like actually I can basically be myself at my job. You know, that it doesn't matter if they, what I've done at the weekend, it doesn't matter what kind of music I'm listening to while I'm working. I'm finding, so at the moment, I started a new job in November, and I've been fortunate enough to find something that's actually pretty cool that I like doing. Like, I've found a job that I like a lot. And one of the greatest things about it, though, is that it's working from home. So I can wear whatever I want. I can wear, well, I'm wearing As Thieves merch at the moment. But, you know, I wear this As Thieves sweatshirt to work every day on top of a band t-shirt because they can see this on Zoom and not know what it is. You know what I mean? Like, but, you know, I can listen to whatever music I want if I'm working from home. I can wear whatever I want if I'm working from home. I can, you know, I can nip out for a break if I need to. Or I can switch around my day so that I do a bit more in the evening and a bit less during the day if I'm not feeling like, you know, my job involves a lot of writing. So if I'm not feeling creative at lunchtime, I could just do it at 7-8 o'clock instead and that's fine. And, yeah, I think finding something where you can really be yourself and keep that identity that you've got as a musician, you know, in your day job as well.
Yeah.
That's perfect, isn't it? You can start to align all the different parts of your life.
Yeah.
That's where happiness comes from, I reckon.
Yeah, it definitely is. Definitely is.
Yeah. Yeah. On that note, should we play a song? Why don't we play a track from Traits? You picked one for us. Is there any particular reason that you wanted The Good, The Bad and The Downright Ugly?
That second EP for me, I was really proud of it. It sounds great. I don't know, those songs were all a lot of fun to play. You know, they were a lot of fun to play. And, you know, those guys, you know, Johnny and Dan were on another level with regards to singing and stuff that I wasn't really used to. I've, you know, I've, I've spent 10 years harmonizing to Robin, you know, which kind of gives you, you know, Robin's like an incredible talent, but like to, you know, he's not really singing much. It's a lot of shouting.
He's not a singer. And like, no.
So when you're backing that up with harmonies and stuff, you get to be the creative one. You know, you get to be the one that has and Dan's really good at constructing that kind of stuff. So we were adding the layer of creativity to a lot of those lines with regards to like melody and stuff. So we were in control. Whereas in this thing, you know, Johnny's going and he's bringing the melody, and then it's like, you've got to be constructed into that to make that work, which is something I've never had to do before, you know? And like I say, I'm the doer, not necessarily the thinker in a lot of ways with regards to writing, with regards to a lot of the writing and stuff, you know? So I don't, you know a lot of theory. So it was really pushed me out of my comfort zone in a great way. You know, I feel like I've got a better grip on that stuff than I ever did. But yeah, that, you know, it's such a fun album to do. And I just remember really, I just loved singing that chorus. I loved it.
Brilliant. Well, let's give that a go again. So this is Traits with The Good, The Bad and The Downright Ugly. That was Traits with The Good, The Bad and The Downright Ugly. What I'd really like to ask you about is a bit more of your musical background. So we've been talking about how being a musician is part of an identity, but you grew up with a really musical family in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a bit about how was it growing up with, you know, a family full of musicians?
At the time when you're going through it,
it just seems like normal.
You don't question it.
Yeah.
It's just normal, you know. But like, I was on tour from the like 2 months old.
Wow.
You know, I was a bit looked after. So my parents, when I was, well, they were always singing. They were in a band as like, just as I was born, with a very famous singer-songwriter at the time called John Renborn. And he basically started this group called The Ship of Fools. So my mum was pregnant with me while they were touring. And then, like, my mum did it, you know, my mum was gigging right up until like 2 nights before she, you know, I came out, you know, probably with a glass of wine and a roll up in her hand as well, you know. So, you know, that is, so I was straight out on the road with them. And then not very long after that, they got into being the onstage band for the Ballyram Bear had a thing called Sergeant Early's Dream, which is all about the transports from Ireland to America. Mm. So it was a big ballet, and they were part of the live band on stage. And like my uncle was in that, who sadly passed away as well. And a few other really amazing musicians were in this on stage band. And I was like looked after by, you know, up until I was 2 years old, looked after in a, you know, by the wardrobe lady while they were on stage and stuff, you know. So like I just kind of grew up in it, you know. It was so normal to me that like all these people were coming over that were musicians. And, you know, it wasn't till like maybe I was even like in my 20s that I realized how ridiculous it was and how lucky I was to know some of the people that were there. Like, you know, we just sitting around the kitchen table with Bert Jansch, you know, who's like was one of the most influential. He was the guy that was either him or Bob Dylan, you know what I mean? Brilliant. That was going to be this big thing. And Bert Jansch didn't quite make that cut, but he was still massive, you know, yeah, in that scene. And all these, you know, then like, you know, Bert Jansch did loads of stuff with like people like Bernard Butler from Suede.
Oh, yeah.
And Johnny Marr and all this kind of stuff. So I grew up with these people like just as my parents' mates, you
That's
know,
brilliant.
Not legends, you know. And yeah, it hasn't, it's definitely seeps into you. And it's definitely stranger now thinking about how wild that is. but it, I don't know, to get to a point of it, it's been quite interesting digesting like Random Hand and my need for it, in a way, compared to my band members.
Yeah.
So when Random Hand started, like, we, me and Robin had been in a band before, which Dimmers was very briefly in, before Random Hand, called Nosebone. And we, when that band stopped, and then we started Random Hand, and we just said, we're going to do this. We're going to gig, we're going to get out of town. We're not going to be a band that is just big in their own town. Like, okay, cool, gotcha. So our second gig was in Huddersfield. Like, yeah, no band from Keighley, where there's a bunch of teenagers, had gone further than Bradford. You know what I mean? So we, you know, I rang up, I literally lied through my teeth and went, our van's broken, so can we borrow some equipment? We didn't have a van, we didn't have any equipment. You know, but that was, you know, that was me from day one. It was the blag to get us to the gigs and all that kind of stuff. And we, that was it, you know. And I remember, like, for me, it was just, well, that's what we do. That's you
normal.
Do, isn't it? You know, and Robin was like, oh, can we do this? You know, so we just do gigs. And I was like, you know, and that kind of, it's almost like now, when I'm sat here chomping at the bit, wishing we were doing more,
yeah,
that conversation almost frames the reality of it perfectly for me.
I think that sums it up really well.
I'd grown up in it, and my measure of success was people being on stage singing to people. It wasn't earning any. It certainly wasn't earning any money because my parents were broke, you know.
Yeah.
But like, it was never about that. It was about music and performance and just being happy in what you're doing. And that has always been my measure. And I'm kind of going through a bit of a decompression of that at the moment, and like kind of having to unpick that and kind of realize that that's not the DNA of the other members of the band. You know, it's my DNA, and I have to come to terms with the fact that the rest of the band don't have the same, they don't have the same reasons to want to be on stage every night. They don't have the same reasons to go out and do Random Hand and make it so it is happening 30 nights a
yeah.
year or 50 nights a year.
They're
just happy the fact that it is happening in 10, you know, and it's...
Yeah. It isn't that they don't have their own reasons, but I agree that it feels like a different... I think people have different approaches. And my question, which you've kind of already answered, I was going to say, you know, how do you feel that having such a musical background growing up has influenced you now as a musician? But I think that explains it perfectly. It's just given you a grounding.
It does. I mean, it does. But it's like, I suppose, you know, going back to this idea of success and stuff, like my dad, you know, he you know, made his living and always has been a singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
You know, he had one job when he was like in his when he was 20, which he got fired from because he took a sick day off to go and play a gig in London, and that was it. That was his last day of working for anyone else. You know, and he's done that for 50 years, and I don't know. It'd be very easy for him to like kind of look at my situation and go, "Why aren't you doing more and being myself?" But actually, my dad's quite tuned into it. He's like, I don't know how anyone in your situation has managed to even do close to a living, because he's seen how much it's decimated his,
you know,
never mind. And it's like, so I'm trying and I'm comparing myself to my dad and trying to be like able to do that, and my mum to some extent, you know, comparing myself to that situation. But it's not the same battleground, you know, it's not the same industry.
No.
You know, I haven't got.
I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about with streaming and vinyl and income before. The musical landscape's changed. So although I think that's really interesting, actually, the question of success. I think, I don't know about you, but I think over the years I've reframed what I consider success. Or actually, maybe when I was younger, I wasn't really sure what I thought success was. But it's a strange thing. Actually, also, I think, I don't know about you, but sometimes I don't necessarily think of myself as successful, but sometimes I'm interested to see how I'm framed from my parents' perspective. Does that make sense? So, in each of our upbringings, we'd have different parental expectations. And my parents, for example, were always very kind of encouraging in that they were quite open to me doing what I thought was best. But also I think there was a little part of them that wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer or one of those things. And now I'm none of those things whatsoever. And, you know, instead I kind of frame my identity around kind of these more creative pursuits. But I think they're probably more proud of me for doing that than they would have been if I'd have gone off and, you know, been working as a GP, I guess.
Yeah. I'm not a parent. But I think a parent would, in most cases, would probably be just want a kid to be happy. You know,
that's a fair point.
I know that isn't a very. I know a lot of parents.
Maybe
parents that live
vicariously
through their kids and stuff. And
happy and safe.
And I think there are many. There's probably more measures of success that a parent would afford a child than a child would afford themselves. If that makes sense.
I think you're probably quite right.
So,
yeah.
Like, I think, you know, that you've got more chance of making your parents proud by just as long as you're doing something and you're keeping it going. Whereas you would probably, like, I'm likely only to measure myself to what my dad's done, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas actually my dad's really happy. He was really happy that I worked for that charity. He's really happy that I'm doing all right now. He was really happy when I was touring as a musician. He was, you know, he's always been happy that I've been putting my all into what I've done.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I never thought about it like that, and I probably needed you to say that. Thank you very much.
There you go.
Sarah.
See, this is important. Do you know, this is actually one of the great things about podcasting that I'm finding through lockdown. I mean, obviously I was podcasting before, and I haven't done a huge amount of podcasting that involved talking to other people, because I'm always a bit, you know, I don't think you get quite the same energy over video call sometimes. I think we're a bit more used to it now. But one of the greatest things about it is that you can kind of discuss stuff in a bit more depth than you might over a pint. But also it gives you the opportunity to catch up with people that you're not getting to see otherwise, which is so nice. One last thing I wanted to ask you about was kind of your creative process at the moment. Are you still doing any writing, or are you not feeling up to it at the moment? Have you got too much on?
There was,
and it doesn't have to be like a structured song,
really. So,
you know, just any kind of creative flair.
No, well, yeah. So when we when everything kind of first fell down, there was very much a bit of a drive to get some random hand stuff together. I think we through bouncing things round, we managed to kind of craft four or five really nice ideas that were just between me, Dan and Sean, which is sounding great. Robin's kind of reflected on them and stuff, but that kind of stopped in November and nothing's really been picked at them since. But, you know, at least a little bit of groundwork's been put in there. So when we get an opportunity, we will see stuff happen. The thing is, Random Hand's always been a in the room together, make it happen. It's never really flourished outside of that environment. But for me, I've just been, I have been like, when I've had a chance, I've kind of got into doing a bit of creative stuff and writing and things, and just, I've actually been writing for writing's sake musically rather than writing for a project, if that
makes
sense.
That's good though. I think that's
so
always.
I've written a load of rock songs, punky rock songs that are just for me. I've always lamented the fact that I haven't been the singer in a band. Do you know what I mean? The lead singer. And I think part of the reason why I haven't is because I don't sound like the people I want, that I love, if that makes sense. Like,
I know what you mean.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I've got a folky voice, you know, like I can go punky as a backing and that kind of stuff. But like all my heroes are like, you know, people that fucking scream.
I tell you,
you know?
What, I can really understand that. And the reason why is because the reason why I've never wanted to be able to do that. Like, I like singing at home. I really do. And I do it all the time. But for the life of me, I can never, ever, ever sound like my heroes. And as a result, I'd never want to be in that kind of band, you know, like, but for me, it's that most of my heroes are guys and they've got a certain timbre in the voice that I can't reach.
Yeah, yeah.
I can sing like an Atomic Kitten song pretty nicely, but that doesn't fit into my punk
me
rock
too.
Roots. Yeah. And it's horrible that, and that puts me off ever wanting to do it really.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're right, screamers.
I
can't scream or shout.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think through working the way I've been working and working with, I mean, basically I've been listening to a load of stuff that I used to listen to before I got really into the punk world.
Yeah.
And so I grew up in a pretty small town. There wasn't a punk scene. You know what I mean? Like, there wasn't, you know, and... You know, but we found out about punk when TFI Friday had The Offspring on, you know, like, you know, so that's kind of, and that's where, you know, people that were in punk scenes were already calling those guys sellouts by then. And we were like, this is the best thing ever.
Yeah. No, I know that feeling. So, that's kind of how I found out about it as well.
Yeah,
my dad told me about The Offspring.
So like up until then, like.
my dad put Smash on.
I was listening to.
Don't worry.
I think we've gone out of sync. We've gone out of sync. Are we back?
Da 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 da. Yes. Oh, you've frozen.
Well, we'll try.
No.
Carry
on,
back?
Joe.
Are we back?
It's
is
all right.
It working? Okay. Yeah. So, like, The Offspring and all that kind of stuff came in when we were all like 16, 17. So, but up until then, all I was listening to was like Supergrass and Placebo and Stereophonics and like Manic Street Preachers and that kind of stuff. And I suppose I've kind of got back into... I've just kind of revisited a bit of that stuff and then, like, Idlewild and a few other things and a few bands that aren't quite down the punk side of things that I've really got into recently. Well, I say recently, for the last 15 years. yeah, so kind of revisited that stuff and I'm like, hang on, there's loads of really hard-hitting music here and people sound more like I do. Maybe I should just do it. So I have just been demoing some stuff by myself and I don't know if it's for any rhyme or reason.
It doesn't need to be. I don't think
nice
you should
to
get too hung up
no,
on
it. No, it doesn't. Yeah. It absolutely doesn't. But it's been nice to kind of get into that and remind myself that I'm a musician, which is kind of what I needed to do with that after being sat on an album, which I haven't gigged. I haven't, you know, the last gig I did with the solo stuff was 18 months ago.
Wow.
You know, I did a couple of things that being in a lockdown, but that just doesn't really feel like it counts. And yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, Random Hand was nearly a year ago. So, to do something fresh has been fun. Out of my comfort zone.
I think that's exactly the right thing to do, you know. And I don't think there's anything wrong with just writing. Obviously, I don't do any kind of songwriting because I'm terrible at such things. But I do write an awful lot. I probably over the last year, I've not really done a lot of articles for Shout Louder. I just, you know, I haven't had anything I wanted to talk about, but that doesn't mean I've not been writing. Jesus, like I've written a lot of stuff that will never see the light of day and that's fine. You know, it's just sometimes fun to create, like kind of flex that creative muscle and play with it. It's fun. It doesn't have to be for a purpose or a project or anything like that.
Are you not tempted to like release more of it?
I am
in a kind of
non-pressured
way, like just like blog it or something.
Yeah, I am to an extent. I wrote some stuff about I wrote some stuff about drinking and about addiction and stuff like that. And I had considered putting that out because I thought that it might be quite relatable to a few people. But then I was hesitating because I didn't want to end up becoming like some spokesperson for sobriety out of it. You know, I didn't want to become like the outreach person for anyone with a drinking problem. I just wanted to talk about my own experiences, you know. And then I thought, you know what, I've written all of this, but it's fine to just sit there. And if there's someone who wants to read it, they can, but I don't need to do anything with it. And then, I don't know, I think I set myself the goal, not this year, but last year, like in 2019, I set myself the goal of writing every single day for the year. Because if you get used to the act of writing, it just becomes easier. Like it flows more naturally. And when you need to sit down at a page, it just comes to you. And I didn't manage it every single day, but I was pretty close. But out of that, you know, some days I don't have anything I want to talk about, but I just made myself write something down anyway. So I've got all these little snippets of like kind of film noir type scenes that I've written.
That's amazing.
Yeah, little odd bits of films and stuff like that. And I'd love to be able to pull that together. I'm now starting just to think about writing some fiction and maybe actually releasing it. So, yeah, I don't know. We're crossing over. It's a new time for that. There is one reason, though, that I would really like your solo album to be properly released and that I will pressure you for it. And that's because I played a track from it, I think Rains, on a podcast in, like, the summer. And my dad listened to it, and he really loved it, and he pestered me and asked me if he could buy your album.
That's very nice.
I thought that was really sweet, and then I was like, I don't think it's been released yet.
No, it hasn't.
No. But I would say don't feel the pressure to do it. It's there. Mm. It'll be ready for when it's ready for you. And
there's so many layers of stuff with that album though. Like my it's the whole project is a grief project.
Yeah.
Like because of the loss of my mum, really.
Yeah.
And like that when my mum died, I literally could not pick up the guitar. I could not play, I could not write because the moment I picked it up, there's a place that I went to and it was my mum.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that you know, I'm still kind of battling with that. The moment I pick up an acoustic guitar, you know, I just go there, you know. And it took me 2 years to get to a place where I felt like I could finish writing that album. And then another year to finish writing it. And then I recorded it. And then now I've been sat on it. And the thing is with the first solo album, I released that at that point when Random Hand kind of had the full meltdown, which involved the lineup change, you know. And that got released. And I was so exhausted by Random Hand. I was so conditioned to be in a unit with other people that I just did not have the energy or any momentum to make it anything that I felt like to really give it, to justify it, and I mean, like, to make it what it needed to be. And then a year later after that, my mum died. So I kind of, it took the wind out of my sails in every way. And then now I'm sat here with this album that I don't feel I've got any momentum for. I'm also actually really proud of it.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
in a
fantastic
way that I've never been proud of the other stuff. Like, I'm amazed that it's come together, but I'm just convinced that, and again, this is because of all the reasons we've talked about the music industry being so oversaturated and the scarcity. I feel like it's just not going to do anything. Like, I feel, you know, there's this inner feeling in me that I'm sat on this thing and it's going to be no different when I'm not sat on it. It's kind of how I feel about it, you know. And
I suppose,
a complete fear of it just, and not inaction at the moment is full of potential. Actually releasing it has no potential. It's done.
It's funny that, isn't it? I completely understand.
Yeah.
But I think by the sounds
of it, I'm trying to do is I'm trying to build up as much potential as possible. I'm trying to make videos. I'm trying to do all this stuff so I can fall from a greater height, but at least I did everything I could.
It's the physics of a literal album drop though, isn't it? You know, while you've got it held in the air waiting to drop, it has the potential energy that's going to drag it to the ground, but you don't know what's going to happen when it actually gets out there. But I think I don't know, I think that creativity and all that kind of thing, it ebbs and flows, right? And it sounds to me as though you've had this very, very long process that's gone into that album, and it's grown and it's built and it's developed, and you've had all these ideas from what you might want to do with it. And I imagine there will come a time when it does feel like a good idea. Like, it just, it sounds to me like it's, like you said, it's a grief project as well. It might, there might be a point in life where you get to it and go, I'm going to release this into the world, and I'm going to put that stage, and I'm going to let that sit on that shelf. And I can look at it sometimes, and I can go back to it, and I can remember how I felt at that time. But that's that project there. And then you'll have a point at the moment, you're not ready to move on from that and to let go of it. And I think that there'll come a time when you are, you know, like, I'm just excited because it's, well, obviously I've heard it and it's really fucking good, Joe. It's so good. it's definitely, it's one of your best musical achievements. It's excellent.
Well, that means a lot. It's easy. With the 30th thing, I also forget that there's a couple of people who have heard it. So when it is nice to hear that.
Well, it was funny because I heard it so long ago that I was like, has it not been released? I don't know.
Yeah, you're probably one of 20 people that have heard it.
Oh, I feel very privileged. Yeah. That's really kind of you. Yeah. It's interesting because obviously it's a folk album, but I grew up with a lot of folk as well, separately. My dad and I used to go to Beautiful Days Festival, which is run by the Levellers, so it's got a kind of a punk background, but it's a folk festival. Anyone who's been there, it's a folk festival, you know. And we used to sit there and watch all these like incredible acoustic acts, and we'd have that mixed up with something like Dropkick Murphys or Dead Kennedys, and you'd flip from punk to acoustic. So I really like the mix of both. But yeah, no, it's honestly, it's a wonderful album. I'm really excited for when you do feel ready to release it into the wild.
My plan is, once I've got 3 videos signed off, that's when I create a release date.
Well, if in doubt, basically, mate, just get one of your friends to dress up in a giant penis costume and push them in the lake.
Not sure it's the vibe, Sarah.
No? I mean, it worked so well before. well, I tell you what, Joe, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I should probably let you get back to your evening of VR golf and RuPaul's Drag Race or whatever you're doing.
I've already watched RuPaul's. That's why we put the thing back.
We just need to not talk about it because I've not seen it yet. So
well, there was some disasters on the disastrous dresses.
Oh God.
Disastrous.
Well, I'm going to watch it as soon as we finish this. So I need to catch up before everyone spoils it for me. I will say, though, that the UK one this year is so much stronger than the American one at the moment. But
certainly
I believe
is.
It at that. I can say that it has taken me through lockdown. It has gently lifted me through the dark times as Drag Race. I went back and rewatched every single episode of it, all 12 seasons, at some point in September, I think. And I binged Drag Race. And I tell you what, I'm stuck here in my flat by myself. And for a good few weeks, every time I walked up and down my corridor, my hallway, I was doing it like I was on a catwalk. Doing like a... and singing RuPaul in my head.
We got into it, I think it was the year before lockdown.
Yeah.
So basically, I love watching stuff with people. I love it.
Yeah.
Like it kind of, it's always played a part of my relationships. Like I've got TV series in common with people and we all talk about that shit. And it's just a bonding thing. And I love like it when people buzz off things and so it's a big part of who I am. And like my wife just doesn't have that same,
really,
that same thing.
Yeah.
She just doesn't have it. And it's like, so I've been desperately trying to kind of, will you watch this thing? Will you watch this thing? How about this thing? And then it's like really struggling to get these things to watch together. And I was just desperate to find something.
Drag Race,
like,
is the one.
So Drag Race came along and I was like, definitely not on paper. And no one else was watching it. None of my friends were watching it at the time.
Yep.
Like, not, well, male friends, you know, like lots of girls were watching it. And I was like, just suggested, would you be up for watching this? She was like, yeah, all right. And that was it. We were hooked.
Amazing.
We watched the whole thing.
Yeah.
The whole thing, back to back, constantly. And we found the thing that we could sit down and watch together.
Oh, that's perfect.
So it gave me this thing. It's also been a gateway because she's now watched loads of other stuff because she's now seen the value of having a thing. So I had to kind of get myself into this. And it was weird at first. It felt weird. and now I'm fully on board, fully dragged in. I've actually got a video. So this is happening in the lockdown. I performed for a ladies' night for a festival that got cancelled.
Yeah.
And it was part of a big, long stream, but I did two songs in drag, and I don't think anyone saw
amazing.
It, anyone that I know, but I've got them.
Oh, my God.
I'll send them to you after this.
That's going to be amazing.
I feel like that is...
It's a really strangely important show, and it's one of the first things where it's a real TV phenomenon that's spread across so many people that I've phenomenon. Actually also been interested in. Phenomenon. But I'm normally not interested in big shows. It kind of makes me go, oh, you know, yeah. No, I don't want to be. But this is one thing where I can totally grip hold of it and be like, this is fucking brilliant. And also, I'm not, you know, I don't wear makeup. I don't do my hair and stuff like that. And I never have done.
Me neither.
I know, right?
Me neither.
But then I started watching Drag Race, and all of a sudden, for the first time in my life, I had the urge to put eyeshadow on.
Me too.
Well, this is it. So I, you know, I was talking to some other girls who don't like dress up too much, and we want to get dragged up as well and go have a night out where we all have like massive hair and all that kind of thing. That's all I want from life. Maybe that's what I'll do when we, you know, I nearly did that as a birthday party last year, but I ended up putting on a fucking punk gig instead.
There's going to be a lot more drag after lockdown.
There really is.
That's for sure.
There really is. But yes, I'll leave things on that super positive note. I'm going to go and watch Drag Race. I advise everyone else to do the same. But to play us out, we'll play one of your solo tracks off the Magical Unreleased album.
Yeah.
I think we wanted to play Watch Them. Is there a particular reason you've chosen that track?
Well, I just I like it.
That's a good enough reason.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's not really a folk song, and I know I've come from a folky background, but I don't. There's a lot of rock in that album,
oh, yeah.
in a few songs and stuff, and this is one of them in particular that just kind of goes to a place that I think people wouldn't be expecting.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's also very much about the end of the world and kind of its
relevant.
Imminence. It was called Existential Threat for a very long time, but it was inspired by the Doomsday Clock from Watchmen.
Cool.
So I came up with a better name, Watch Them.
Ah,
so there we are.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Oh, very clever. Excellent. Yeah. Well, we'll play Watch Them off your new solo album to play us out. But thank you so much. For coming on, Joe. It's
Thank
been wonderful
you.
Getting to actually chat to you properly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
yeah,
good luck for the rest of the remaining lockdown. I hope to see you at a gig soon.
Yeah. See you in lockdown 4.
Cheers.
This is a tragedy. I hear you shout. Apathy is our failing. We're searching for certainty, yet live in doubt. Salvation is our calling. Holy minutes to midnight, why are we? So close to midnight, why are we? Yeah, this is a tragedy, without a doubt. It seems like there is nothing that could pull us back. There's no chance of certainty, and we still shout. There is no time left to get this wrong. Holy, it is to midnight. Why are we? Holy, so close to midnight. We'll be right back. close to midnight. Why?